Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, Barack Obama wasn't running for anything this election season, but you might have thought he was, judging from the media coverage he generated. Obama's appeal extends across the political and pundit spectrum. Indeed, finding anything approaching critical coverage of the freshman senator is next to impossible. So what's going on here? Glenn Ford of the Black Agenda Report joins us to talk about it. Also on Counterspin today, we know that media can turn any factoid into a phenomenon when they choose. After the last election, we were subjected to months of discourse on how voters put moral values above all else based on a single exit poll question. So what will media make of the fact that, in the midterm elections, proponents of so-called free trade agreements were handed their hats, especially given that those trade agreements enjoy such unequivocal endorsement in the elite media? We'll hear from Chris Slevin of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. That's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
Well, the lesson the media took from the midterm elections was that conservative Democrats were the real winners. The Washington Post's editorial page stuck to that script on November 14th when they argued against Congressman John Murtha's bid to become majority leader. The reason? Murtha's against the Iraq War. But when the Post sought to make its case, things got a little muddy. The paper argued that, quote, Al-Qaeda is known to play a major part in the insurgency, close quote. But it's widely agreed that Al-Qaeda are a small part of the mostly homegrown Iraqi insurgency. The Post also claimed that Murtha's call for redeployment of U.S. troops in Iraq is, quote, an extreme step that most congressional Democrats oppose, close quote. Well, that's hard to square with the fact that about half the Democrats in Congress have co-sponsored Murtha's resolution. It's proof, if any more were needed, that some positions on the Iraq War, supported by large segments of the U.S. public, are derided by the mainstream media. With the debate over withdrawing troops from Iraq intensifying, the New York Times splashed on its November 15th front page a story that was headlined, Get Out of Iraq Now, Not So Fast, Experts Say. The Times saw fit to rely on just three experts, former military officers Anthony Zinni and John Batiste, and Ken Pollack of the Brookings Institution. The latter was one of the most forceful proponents of the Iraq War, arguing across the media that Iraq's WMDs were a true threat to the United States. Why such voices should be trusted now is hard to figure. Then again, that's true of the Times reporter who wrote this story, Michael Gordon. He was the lead author of the Times' famously discredited pre-war story about aluminum tubes Iraq was using in its nuclear weapons program. Being that wrong never seems to disqualify anyone from being a media expert.
Well, it's rare that women make it to the top of U.S. politics, but what's not rare is how most are treated by the mainstream media. One staple of such coverage is the obsession with clothes. We aren't really sure what kinds of suits Trent Lott wears, but we sure know what designer labels incoming Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi prefers. That's not the only brand of media sexism, of course, and Pelosi's sudden media stardom has brought out several varieties. Washington Post columnist David Broder, for one, cheered Pelosi's bipartisanship after the midterms, writing on November 9th that, quote, her debut as leader of a congressional majority was pitch perfect, calm, confident, and blessedly free of the screeching tone of some of her stump speeches, close quote. A screeching woman. Now that's a new one. Perhaps you could give Broder the benefit of the doubt. Maybe he really meant Pelosi was speaking too loudly at a campaign rally. Consider the comment, though, from MSNBC host Chris Matthews. On his November 13th show, Matthews was weighing in on the battle among Democrats for majority leader. Pelosi was backing John Murtha against Congressman Steny Hoyer, leading Matthews to blurt out, quote, is she going to castrate Steny Hoyer if he gets in there? Close quote. So you get that. Powerful women as screeching, castrating threats. Power may have changed hands in Washington. Crude media sexism isn't going anywhere.
Spinning language to try to force your own interpretation of an issue is a time-honored technique, but you've got to admit that U.S. conservatives have gone at it with particular relish, coaching proponents to say climate change instead of global warming, for example, or to talk about having personal Social Security accounts instead of privatizing them. In the same vein, Republicans pushing for the repeal of the estate tax, that only affects about 2% of U.S. families, but whose repeal, by congressional estimates, could cost treasuries billions of dollars, insisted on referring to the death tax, which, besides sounding spooky, implies a cost paid by everyone who dies, rather than a wealthy few. It was one of the more obvious, even laughable attempts to spin an issue, and most reporters, if they use the phrase, set it up with a "what conservatives call," or at least a "so-called." CBS's Cheryl Atkinson must have missed that memo, though. There she was on CBS Evening News on November 9th, offering a post-election assessment about how Democrats would be moving into the driver's seat after 12 years of being backseat drivers, as she put it. In terms of fiscal policy, Atkinson explained to viewers, Democrat Charlie Rangel's becoming chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, quote, might mean higher taxes on upper-income Americans and perhaps reinstituting the death tax, close quote. I suppose we should be grateful she didn't suggest those tax and spend Democrats would declare class warfare.
Well, when the wrong people win Democratic elections, sometimes journalistic standards of accuracy and fairness get thrown out the window. This was true of a November 12th Washington Post report about the victory of Sandinista presidential candidate Daniel Ortega in the November 5th Nicaraguan elections. Post reporter N.C. Eisenman summarized recent Nicaraguan history like this, quote, through a controversial decade-long campaign of ambushes and sabotage, the Contras, estimated to number as high as 12,000 at their peak, helped pressure Ortega into holding elections in 1990 in which voters swept him from office, close quote. Aside from that overly polite description of the murderous campaign of terror waged by the Contras as ambushes and sabotage, the piece glaringly omitted the 1984 Nicaraguan elections, in which Ortega won 67% of the vote in balloting that international observers found to be free, fair, and hotly contested. It also ignores the fact that the 1990 elections were held not because of Contra pressure, but as scheduled by the Sandinista written constitution. Interestingly, the piece referred later to the Contras as, quote, armed, trained, and largely run by the CIA, close quote. This is a fact, of course, but it's a fact that Washington Post media critic Howard Kurtz has denied in broadsides against Contra crack scandal reporter Gary Webb. Surely Kurtz won't let a Post reporter now make the same hideous error in his own paper.
And finally, though it's hardly the first lie George W. Bush has told while in office, his assurance to reporters 2 weeks before the midterm election that Donald Rumsfeld would stay on as Secretary of Defense was perhaps the first lie Bush has actually admitted to, as he did at his November 8th press conference. While it's evidently extremely hard for Bush to cop to his lies, it seems the press corps has an even harder time with it. There's something of an unwritten rule in the mainstream media that, as the former New York Times Bush beat reporter Elizabeth Buemiller put it, you can't just say the president is lying. In the wake of Bush's Rumsfeld lie, that rule was echoed by the Washington Post's Howard Kurtz, who noted on November 9th that, quote, journalists by nature shy from pinning the liar label on any political leader, close quote. That observation came, appropriately, under the Are They Really Serious headline, President's Evasion Raises Truth Issues. But the Post had actually seemed to defy the rule when, immediately after Bush's press conference, a report on their website noted that Bush, quote, appeared to acknowledge having misled reporters, close quote. Blogger Glenn Greenwald took note, but then he was startled to find out that sometime soon after publishing the article, the Post edited the piece and deleted that phrase. It had also changed a line saying Bush, quote, had made the decision to replace Rumsfeld before the elections, close quote. They replaced that with one saying he had only contemplated the ouster. As Greenwald pointed out, the original version was completely accurate, and the Post left no indication that it had made the change in the new version, leaving no trace of the excised truth except in the blogosphere. Apparently, the Buemiller rule is so strict that you can't just say the president is lying, even if he admits it himself. And if you do accidentally say that, you'd better go back and unsay it.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR.
He He wasn't running for office this campaign season, but judging by the volume of media coverage, you might have thought that freshman Senator Barack Obama was. The very sudden rise of Obama's political career has reporters pegging him as a serious contender for the White House in 2008, and he enjoys praise across the pundit spectrum. In an age of sparring TV talking heads, Obama's bright political future is one thing they all seem to agree on. So why is that? Well, Glenn Ford is the executive editor of the Black Agenda Report, a weekly online magazine of African-American political thought and action. He joins us now to talk about that. Glenn Ford, welcome to Counterspin.
Oh, so glad to be here.
Now, it's hard to overstate the media's love for Obama. Right-wing pundits like David Brooks, Charles Krauthammer have cheered on talk of a White House run, while even acknowledging that there are these ridiculous expectations out there. Joe Klein of Time magazine wrote that Obama, quote, transcends the racial divide so effortlessly that it seems reasonable to expect that he can bridge all the other divisions and answer all the impossible questions plaguing American public life, close quote. What do you make of all this?
Barack Obama is a prince of ingratiation. That seems to be his principal talent. In the process, of course, he commits acts of betrayal of his former self. As a Illinois state senator from the south side of Chicago, Barack Obama was a sterling progressive. Mm-hmm. He was a champion of universal health care. But all that changed when he decided he would run for statewide office. And we have seen him drift rightward and rightward and rightward ever since, in actually a record-breaking span of time.
And as he drifts further right, the media can't seem to get enough of it.
What he has done is give, let's put it very bluntly, he's given white people a kind of satisfaction that race no longer matters in America, and that all the sins of the past can be washed away through the act of loving this man. They really do love him. And he's encouraging that. I think it's quite cynical.
Now, let's talk about Iraq. You mentioned his past, and that is part of his past. Probably one of the only things the Democratic base knew about him was that he was opposed to the Iraq War very early on. New York Times columnist Frank Rich claimed recently that, quote, it's important to remember that on one true test for his party, Iraq, he was consistent from the start, close quote. Where's Barack Obama today on Iraq, though?
You know, he began reversing on that very early. In his early campaign, he displayed on his campaign website his rather fiery speeches mm-hmm. against the war. After he won the primary, he took all of that material off of his website as if it had never existed. In anticipation of running statewide, he put that whole machine into reverse. So this is not something that's just happened since he won election. It happened after he won the primary.
It's important to remember, too, before his career really took off, the National Democratic Party didn't have a keen interest in him. He wasn't their favored candidate out of Illinois. So he did rise rather quickly. One of the terms you hear constantly, and we touched on this before, but we should talk about it some more in the coverage of Barack Obama, is this idea that he, and this is the phrase you hear all the time, he transcends race. It's not the first time we've heard something like this. Certainly Barack Obama isn't the first African-American politician who's been tagged with this label. It's a euphemism for something. What do you think
Absolutely.
That means?
That's the word. The euphemism for transcending race is a euphemism for erasing race. And if you can erase race, then you don't have to deal with race. And Obama has made himself a receptacle for those who would erase race as an issue and therefore not confront the central problem of domestic problem of the United States, which is race and has always been.
Now, you write in the current edition of Black Agenda Report, you write about race in the elections. It involves Harold Ford. It also involves Barack Obama. A lot of the themes that you see in coverage of Obama is true of Harold Ford. He's loved by radio hosts like Don Imus. They can't get enough of Harold Ford. And yet, as a politician, he's one of the few Democrats who was running that isn't going to the Senate come next year.
Harold Ford was the most right-wing member of the Congressional Black Caucus. He aggressively put himself forward in speaking engagements and seminars as a model for what the black politician of the future should be, that he was part of the new wave of black politicians. we at Black Agenda Report consider him to be the most dangerous black man in the country because of that. If he had ascended to the Senate, then he would, in fact, just because of his presence in the Senate, have been considered the role model for black politics, signaling a turn to the right among black politicians, and also an indication, a false indication, that black people as a whole have turned to the right.
Mm-hmm.
We believe that in these past elections, the ideal outcome was achieved, that the Democrats did gain control of the Senate, but Harold Ford lost, and we celebrate that fact.
Well, speaking of what the mainstream press was celebrating, going into this election, you had Harold Ford, Michael Steele in Maryland, Lynn Swann in Pennsylvania. There was a story that the media seemed really eager to write about this election. The problem was that the election didn't seem to turn out that way, and the disappointment was almost palpable among some of the pundits that we wanted these guys to win, and they didn't come through for us. Why were they so heavily invested in these campaigns and these candidates?
The same reason. They want to see what they have predicted or even put forward a so-called analysis existed, that black people are turning to the right. Now, it's very, very important for them to believe this, because blacks are the most progressive voting bloc in the nation. You know, we don't make up that large a proportion of the population, about 13% of the population. But because we vote so consistently progressive, that multiplies our weight. And it also is a reminder that things are not right in this country. If black high-profile right-wing candidates are successful, then it tends again to say that race is no longer a problem and we don't have to do anything about it. It's all part of the same cloth.
And a real disappointment to a lot of the professional pundits who will keep trying to write this story. Well, we've been speaking with Glenn Ford. He's the executive editor of the Black Agenda Report. It's a weekly online magazine of African-American political thought and action. You can read and listen to Glenn's work at blackagendareport.com. Glenn Ford, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for inviting me.
In the midterm elections, as with any event, corporate media tend to zero in on a few favored storylines, while others may be noted and forgotten. Pundits allowed a single, ambiguous exit poll question about values to provoke months of debate about red states and blue states, for example, and supposed moral fissures dividing the country after the last election. It remains to be seen just how deeply or thoughtfully media will explore the implications of one of this election's more marked results, namely the defeat of politicians who were supporters of so-called free trade agreements like NAFTA, and the victories of candidates who actively reject those policies. Joining us now to discuss what happened and what journalists might take away from it is Chris Slevin, Deputy Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Welcome back to Counterspin, Chris Slevin.
Thanks for having me, Janine.
Well, start us off with what Global Trade Watch found in your analysis of the midterm election results in terms of questions of trade policy.
Sure. Even going back to the early part of this cycle there, and maybe even going back to the CAFTA vote, which was in July 2005, there's just a simmering tension as it relates to how to deal with trade and globalization policies. CAFTA, you might recall, was just a one or two vote win for the Bush administration, but public opinion, I think, was certainly on the side of an anti-NAFTA, anti-CAFTA sentiment. And so I think since then, there was just a bubbling around the country, and we saw more than 100 candidates for the House, Senate, and governor running pretty clearly on an anti-NAFTA, CAFTA model platform, and candidates that, you know, were spending money on this in television advertisements, you know, over 25 or 30 ads to talk about how they would stand up against that kind of trade policy and try to reverse course. And saw a lot of earned media in a lot of these congressional districts as well, which is, you know, in the election really resulted in a major shift on this issue, and one that I think we can really go back to the NAFTA debate in the early 90s where Clinton, you know, essentially ran on health care, but, you know, a year later delivered us NAFTA. And he himself, it was written in his autobiography that the NAFTA vote was a contributing factor to the Republicans taking over the House in 94. It really just depressed turnout amongst particularly middle-class Democrats who thought, well, if these guys aren't going to stick up for me in Congress, well, you know, what's the point? And so I think that we've really come, you know, full circle, or at least this is a major step forward towards reconnecting Democrats with middle-class economic issues, and trade is central to that.
Well, one of the things that Lori Wallach from Global Trade Watch had pointed out was that this election sort of diffused the myth of the trade debate being divided between pro-traders and protectionists, because it fell out kind of more complicated than that.
It certainly is, yeah. I think it becomes easy for editors to fall back on the anti-trade people as being simply protectionists or isolationists. It's laziness, I think, that contributes a lot to that, and I think the critique is a lot broader than that. You know, Sherrod Brown, the senator-elect from Ohio, is being, you know, trumpeted a lot as being kind of symbolic of this national trend right now. And he's an internationalist opponent to this policy. I mean, you know, people listen to him. He talks a lot about what this policy has done abroad and what NAFTA has done in Mexico, in addition to what it's done to workers here in America. So I think that there is a broader critique out there, and it takes, you know, some of the more enterprising reporters to go out and find it.
Yeah, so it's harder to put people in that box. That doesn't mean reporters won't try. I always remember a USA Today story that said that the activities of the World Trade Organization, they described them as being little noticed by the public, but said they had energized activists around the world. I find that globalization and trade issues are an area where the disconnect between the public and the press becomes very vivid. Here, people lose their membership in the public once they become active around trade issues. In that light, I wonder what you've made of the media response to the election in terms of trade. There has been some coverage of this.
Yeah, it's unquestionably a story that I think at this point every major national newspaper has taken a crack at, from USA Today to the Wall Street Journal to the New York Times and Washington Post. And I think that they're struggling to kind of handle it in a way. I mean, again, it's undeniably a story. And they either pigeonhole the dissent that's out there into, you know, the protectionist line. And I think there's always been dissent to these trade agreements out there. And usually they pin that as being in the minority, kind of an also-ran in the bottom of a story. But now, you know, very clearly, I think this election affirms that the dissent is in the majority. And so they're caught off guard a little bit. And the New York Times especially, I think, its trade narrative often, you know, they use, like, North and South Carolina textile workers as kind of the dissent out there. And then when they do their big trade piece or try to illustrate the dissent, you know, they often fall into that kind of mold. And it's, mm-hmm. of course, a lot more broad than that right now and widespread across the country.
The Los Angeles Times had an editorial on the 15th in which they said the cause of free trade may be in for a rough time once Democrats take control of both houses of Congress. And they use the term protectionist, and they say fast-track trade authority is endangered and that all of this is unfortunate. What strikes me is what they say next. They're talking about, this is in the context of Vietnam, where trade talks broke off. They say, quote, "Vietnam is far from the only country where free trade has made a profound difference. Open markets create customers for U.S. goods and provide cheap imports for U.S. consumers while improving relations around the world and boosting economies. A successful Doha round would probably do more to relieve poverty in Africa than all the foreign aid doled out to the continent put together," close quote. I guess my question to you, Chris Slevin, is, you know, what's wrong with you that you don't want to relieve poverty in Africa?
Yeah, that's the prevailing frame. And I think just taking a step back from that, fundamentally, I think there's a real disconnect literally in newsrooms and as far as, you know, national papers. I've been working in media relations around trade for a number of years, so I feel like I have some experience and have worked with a lot of reporters, and, you know, most are, you know, hardworking, earnest reporters, but they often come out of, you know, really good schools, and they're taught that free trade is a no-brainer, slam dunk, positive, and any dissent from that is just flat out wrong. And I think that is reflected in a lot of the coverage, where a lot of reporters might have, frankly, more in common with diplomats and ambassadors than they might with steel worker or even some high-tech workers in the Northwest or you know, elsewhere. I think that there's just a fundamental disconnect that exists in newsrooms. And as you guys well know, there are not a lot of labor reporters out there anymore, a lot of papers that have a labor beat. there's workplace reporters or people that kind of cover, you know, work from more of a style or trend angle, but there's not a lot of, other than, you know, say Stephen Greenhouse at the New York Times and a couple other reporters, you know, here and there. There's not a beat really that's dedicated to looking at how middle class workers are really handling the global economy right now.
Well, I read that quote because it just sounds so Pollyanna, you know, improving relations around the world and boosting economies. It sounds so simple-minded.
It's kind of a dogma, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that a lot is based on faith. And I think that we also have 10 or 12 years of lived experience under NAFTA and WTO, which shows that really the majority of people worldwide in rich and poor countries are not better off under this model.
Well, let me ask you finally, the point of this election would seem to be that despite elite media's kind of simple-minded proselytizing, ordinary people seem to be getting beyond this, if you are for good and light, you support free trade at every turn line. I wonder what you think economic activists might take away from this in terms of future organizing.
Well, I think that, and I think you see this in a lot of progressive activism that, you know, we'll still work with the major media and try to get the message out, but it's not going to be the end-all, be-all, too. I think that there's a lot more different resources, certainly on the internet and blogs, and I think that in this election, too, there's a lot more kind of neighbor-to-neighbor activism, kind of following a model that Move On and Americans for Democratic Action, several other groups have used to really just make it more grassroots-based. And I think that a lot of campaigns, too, have recognized that, you know, they're going to spend money on ads and media, but at the same time, there is definitely a lot more out there, and that these people will come out and vote if you reach them, and you don't have to rely on the New York Times or the LA Times editorial board to reach them.
We've been speaking with Chris Slevin. He's Deputy Director of Global Trade Watch at Public Citizen. Thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at FAIR, the Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website, www.fair.org. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.